Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Carolyn Fredrickson, President of the American Constitution Society, who assesses the crisis which followed President Trump's firing of FBI Director James Comey and the threat posed by Trump's actions to the rule of law. Jenny Flanagan of Common Cause, who charges that President Trump's new Election Integrity Commission is a sham, designed to prove a false premise and justify new voter suppression measures. And Kelsey Giuliana, the lead plaintiff in a lawsuit filed by Our Children's Trust, who talks about the progress in their climate change lawsuit that declares the state has an obligation to protect the Earth's atmosphere and future generations. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The United Nations is in the midst of raising $4 billion from donor nations to prevent a full-scale famine that would impact over 20 million people in Somalia, South Sudan, Yemen, and northeast Nigeria. This would be the third major famine to hit Somalia since the early 1990s, sparked by ongoing conflict. Today, Somalia has a stronger government than during the last famine 6 years ago, when the Islamist militant group Al-Shabaab controlled much of the country. Still, aid workers are at risk of being kidnapped by insurgents. As the international community gathered in London to mobilize resources for Somalia, aid workers warned pending U.S. military action could exacerbate the famine, making things worse for the 6 million people dependent on food aid. After over 30 years of civil war and rule by warlords and militias, 2 million Somalis have fled the East African nation. Now, large Somali communities are located across the globe in cities such as Minneapolis, London, and Johannesburg. Last year, Somalis in exile raised over $1.4 billion in aid for the people of the country they left behind, funds totaling nearly 25% of Somalia's economy. Single-payer healthcare advocates introduced the Healthy California Act in the California legislature in February, a one-page bill to establish a comprehensive single-payer health insurance system to cover every resident in the state. The legislation would effectively banish private health insurance companies in the state, which have blocked earlier attempts to move to single-payer healthcare. Financing for the new system remains vague, and the politics of making single-payer in California a reality is uncertain. The American Prospect reports that the debate over single payer in California comes as Republicans in Congress are moving to repeal and replace Obamacare and seeking to roll back Medicaid coverage for the poor. It also comes at a time when the United States is the only industrialized nation in the world without some form of universal health coverage for its citizens. Across developed economies, health coverage is delivered in multiple ways. England and Spain have national health services which provide direct health care. In Canada, the government offers insurance to pay private sector health providers. The U.S. has Medicare, a model single-payer program that currently provides health insurance for citizens over 65, as well as Medicare Part B that incorporates private insurers in the system. Hundreds of workers were evacuated from the Hanford Nuclear Reservation in early May after the collapse of a tunnel where toxic nuclear waste was stored. The collapse occurred at a site where rail cars that had carried contaminated nuclear fuel rods were buried, dating from the 1960s. The U.S. Department of Energy stated that no radiation was released, but the event raised new concern about the ongoing risk of cleaning up the U.S. nuclear weapons complex. The Hanford Reservation was built as part of the Manhattan Project that designed the world's first atomic bomb toward the end of World War II. The site is 150 miles southeast of Seattle and abuts the Columbia River. The most dangerous contaminant in Hanford is 56 million gallons of radioactive liquid waste stored in 177 underground tanks, some of which have leaked. Washington State Attorney General Bob Ferguson filed a lawsuit against the U.S. Department of Energy and its prime contractor at Hanford for allowing toxic vapors to be released from underground storage tanks, harming workers' health and safety. Over the years, these vapors have caused multiple illnesses. A massive cleanup of Hanford that began in the late 1980s costs $2 billion a year. The work is expected to take until 2060 and cost more than $100 billion. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
Almost daily, the Trump administration provokes a new scandal, makes official statements which later turn out to be false, or incites government chaos. The latest episode began on May 15th, when the Washington Post reported that President Trump revealed highly classified information during a White House meeting with Russia's U.S. ambassador, Sergei Kislyak, and Moscow's foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov. According to current and former U.S. officials, Trump's disclosures jeopardized a critical source of intelligence on the Islamic State, an assertion that the White House denies. This serious allegation comes just 1 week after Mr. Trump was widely criticized for his firing of FBI Director James Comey as he led an investigation into charges of collusion between Trump's presidential campaign and Russia's effort to influence the outcome of last year's presidential election. While White House officials stated the reasons for Comey's termination were related to his handling of the FBI investigation into Hillary Clinton's misuse of a private email server, the president himself admitted in a TV interview that his decision was driven by this Russia thing, seen by critics as an attempt to obstruct justice. Your reporter spoke with Carolyn Fredrickson, president of the American Constitution Society, who assesses the prospects for a credible investigation into the charges of Russia-Trump election collusion after the Comey firing, and the larger threat posed by Trump to the rule of law and the U.S. Constitution.
Apparently, Jim Comey had dinner with Donald Trump in January in the White House, and according to him, he was asked to give his loyalty to Donald Trump, and he said, "No, I'll give you my honesty. But loyalty is something I give to the Constitution," which is appropriate for a law enforcement officer and anybody who works for the U.S. government, in fact, including the president. You take an oath to uphold the Constitution. So then we get to this week, where apparently Donald Trump was really angry about stories continuing about Russia, about the investigation that the FBI was leading, and decided that he was going to fire Jim Comey. His staff announced a whole slew of different reasons, including from the Deputy Attorney General, Rod Rosenstein, that said that Jim Comey, and this is what was most ludicrous, Jim Comey was fired because he inappropriately handled Hillary Clinton's email investigation and caused harm to Hillary Clinton. So, you know, that doesn't pass the laugh test because none of the Trump people had a lot of compassion to spare for Hillary Clinton on whether the investigation was fair or not. I don't think that was had anything to do with it. Then Trump was on the news with Lester Holt and said, "No, actually, I fired Jim Comey because of this Russian investigation." You know, he said there's nothing there, and so there's sort of the big story. And then subsequently, news stories came out that Jim Comey had told a different version, alternative facts maybe, about what happened during that dinner. And then Trump tweeted, which is a dangerous tool for him, I think, you know, basically that he had tapes, and if the tapes contradicted Comey, he'd be in trouble. So basically threatening Jim Comey with some kind of releasing some tape. And that, of course, has stirred up all sorts of things where, you know, members of Congress have been saying, well, if there are tapes, then you need to turn them over. So, you know, this is a whole set of different issues that are raised, clearly raise questions about the president's understanding of the role of the FBI, the role of the Justice Department as having an independent role to investigate crime, of his role as the president in intimidating, perhaps intimidating a witness, perhaps trying to change somebody's story, perhaps concealing evidence. I mean, there's so many possible causes of action have been raised now. But I think for all of us in the world of, you know, in the legal world, whether you're a Republican, a Democrat, an independent, it's so dismaying to see a president behaving in this way and to think that the FBI director would be swearing an oath of fealty to him. The FBI director needs to, you know, to follow the law and take it, follow it where it leads, and not be ready to put down an investigation because the president would like him to. So we're at a moment which is certainly unique in my lifetime, and I think for most of us, trying to think through what's going to happen. Our government seems, you know, sort of the basic system seems to be threatened. Rule of law is threatened. You know, where's the oversight? Where's the investigation going to be? Can Congress actually sort of shed its partisanship and take on this important job? I certainly hope so. There are other avenues people have suggested, a special counsel. Did the Russians, in fact, influence our election? You know, there's just so many questions, and we really need an independent independent investigator with no agenda, no allegiance to either the president or the Congress, any allegiance that is above his or her allegiance and duty to the Constitution.
Carolyn, the fact that the Republicans have almost total control of the federal government at this point, the question arises, how do citizens put pressure on Washington to move toward a special counsel or an independent commission to credibly investigate the Russia-Trump campaign connections and allegations of collusion? What's the role of a citizen right now in this moment in history? And I'll just parenthetically mention that there's a lot of comparisons being made to what occurred during Watergate. But there were checks and balances in place as the Congress was under the control of the Democrats, the opposition party. There was a bit of conflict and checks and balances. Here, we have a completely different situation.
It's a really good question, and it's one of the reasons why I think many people are concerned. But look, there's no better time than now for people to raise their voices, and it's actually having an impact already. You've already started to hear some Republicans raise concerns. I mean, it's unfortunate that there haven't been more of them, but they're responding to pressure. They're responding to pressure from people contacting their offices. They're responding to pressure from people going to town hall meetings. They are responding to pressure from their local papers and their local radio stations. Radio stations like this one that broadcast news and opinion have a really profound impact on what members of Congress do. Democrats need to work as hard as they can to make sure the concerns are raised. And Republicans need to take the concerns of their voters and their constituents seriously. And, you know, it's all in the hands of the constituents. And I'd say, you know, we're a nonpartisan organization, but I can tell you without being partisan that there's an election coming up in 2018. It's a time when members of Congress are very much paying attention. And so I'd say, you know, seize the opportunity. Everyone who's listening, seize the opportunity, raise your voice. You know, we are approaching a constitutional crisis, and we need Congress to pay attention.
That was Caroline Fredrickson, president of the American Constitution Society. For more perspectives on the Trump presidency, accountability, and the rule of law, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Not long after the 2016 presidential election, Donald Trump declared that he would have won the national popular vote, and not merely the Electoral College, if it hadn't been for millions of illegal votes cast by non-citizens in several states. In fact, Trump lost the popular vote to Hillary Clinton by some 3 million votes, and the repeated charge that there's widespread voter fraud across the U.S. has been debunked by numerous investigations and academic research. Now, in the wake of the controversy generated by Mr. Trump's firing of FBI Director James Comey, the president has signed an executive order establishing a presidential commission to examine election integrity based on his bogus claims of voter fraud. The commission will be chaired by Vice President Mike Pence, and Kansas Secretary of State Kris Kobach will serve as vice chair. Both of these Republican politicians have a long history of supporting voter suppression measures that make it more difficult for specific groups of voters to cast ballots, groups that generally support Democratic candidates. Since 2010, nearly two dozen Republican-controlled state governments have enacted an assortment of new voter suppression laws, many of which have been struck down by federal courts, deeming them to be designed to gain partisan political advantage. Your reporter spoke with Jenny Flanagan, Vice President for State Operations with the group Common Cause. Here she examines Trump's false premise for creating the Election Integrity Commission and the danger of the panel being used as a Trojan horse to justify new voter suppression measures.
There's been a lot of research, and I think notably to stand up to what Trump and other Republicans are saying is the investigation that took place under the Bush administration. George W. Bush also led an investigation searching, as this commission seeks to, for that needle in the haystack of some indication of non-citizens voting in our elections, and they didn't find it. The Brennan Center also conducted, you know, years-long surveys of election challenges where voters may have been subject to claims of voter fraud or wrongful voting. It is more likely to be struck by lightning than it is to have someone have committed voter fraud in this country. It's just not happening. But it is rhetoric that moves people. Most Americans find that it is easy to vote. They make their registration when they go to the motor vehicle office. They know where their polling place is. And for most Americans, that's a wonderful thing. But for many Americans, particularly those who are disenfranchised historically in all aspects of our society, who may not drive and have that driver's license, who are in and out of homes and moving locations frequently, for those individuals, it's more difficult to track down the rules and requirements in order to access your vote. And they're capitalizing on those challenges instead of making it easier.
Jenny, given the fact that Republican-controlled state governments across the country have invoked these voter suppression tactics, deemed as such by federal courts, highly partisan laws that try to gain political advantage for Republican candidates. Given that fact, what is the ultimate objective of this commission in your view? Does the fact that Donald Trump invoked this panel to look at voter fraud mean that the objective possibly could be to justify more repressive voter measures, increasingly make it more difficult for particular groups of voters to cast ballots in future elections?
It absolutely, all signs are pointing in that direction. And that's why we call it a sham. To put these two individuals, Mike Pence and Kris Kobach, who are both known to support these voter suppression laws, in charge of a commission aimed at voting integrity, I think the American public need to look much more closely at what integrity means to them. To us, voter integrity means that every eligible voter can cast their ballot and have it counted accurately with confidence. And with Russian interference in our elections, there were a lot of doubts going into the 2016 election, as there continue to be doubts in terms of what kind of interference took place, whether or not on our voting equipment or trying to influence our elections in other ways. And we deserve better than that as citizens in this country. We deserve voting systems that are modern and up to date. And that's why we're working with election officials all across the country.
Well, one last question for you, Jenny. There are efforts across the country to push back in another direction. There's automatic registration, as many countries across Europe have, where when you're born or get a driver's license or become of majority age, you automatically are registered to vote. Here, there's a lot of games involved and a lot of political partisanship that goes into a lot of the regulations around registering to vote. But maybe you can conclude here by telling us how people can push back against these voter suppression laws and certainly resist what recommendations are likely to come out of this Presidential Election Integrity Commission.
Automatic voter registration is moving in dozens of states across the country with bipartisan support because there are more convenient, more cost-effective ways to register voters with integrity. I'm not afraid of that word. We should have integrity in our voting systems, and we can do it with Democrats and Republicans alike, people who really do care about our democracy. Reforms are moving. Likewise, reforms like combining vote by mail with in-person voting. There are real solutions out there that election officials and civic engagement leaders and elected officials in state legislatures are advancing to make reforms. I think the most important thing that people can do is just keep the pressure on, contacting your lawmaker, whether they're a Democrat or a Republican. Everybody's got a role to play to stand up for our democracy. And if we lose our right to vote, I mean, that is the right to which all other rights flow. This is a civil rights issue. It is a social justice issue. It is really the fundamental core of being American is to participate in our democracy through voting. So it is really critical that we continue to speak up on behalf of all Americans.
That was Jenny Flanagan, Vice President for State Operations with Common Cause. Learn more about efforts underway to challenge voter suppression laws and initiatives to make it easier for eligible voters to participate in elections by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On April 27th, 14 of the 21 youth plaintiffs in a historic lawsuit against the U.S. government held a press conference in front of the Supreme Court building in Washington, D.C. Their case, filed by Our Children's Trust, aims to hold the federal government accountable for the failure to protect their right to a stable climate. A federal district judge in Oregon last April denied a motion to dismiss the lawsuit that was brought by the federal government in the fossil fuel industry, which had joined the Obama administration to oppose the youth plaintiffs' filing. That judge's opinion was confirmed by a second judge in November, setting the case on its way to be adjudicated. At the press event, the young plaintiffs announced that the name of the lead defendant in their suit has now been changed from Barack Obama to Donald Trump. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus was at the event, just 2 days before the People's Climate March in the Capitol, and spoke with 21-year-old Kelsey Juliana, a young woman from Oregon who's the lead plaintiff in the case. Here she explains the evolution of the lawsuit and what the young people who are involved, ages 9 to 21, hope to accomplish.
There are cases across the globe pushing for climate litigation. This in particular case is filed out of the Eugene Federal District Courthouse. It is a federal case. Now, there's also a case that myself is on against the government of Oregon, and that was filed way back in 2011. So there are, actually in 2011, our Children's Trust helped launch a whole fleet of lawsuits. And so they helped inspire and connect young people in their states with local attorneys. And a lot of those cases got dismissed right off the bat. There are still about 5 or 6 cases that are state cases that are still in the courts, supported by Our Children's Trust. But all of those cases are very different. They're at different levels of courts. They're different plaintiffs. So it is I would say it's a joint climate litigation movement. You know, there's cases in India, there's cases in Pakistan, Turkey, you know, all over.
So this was filed against the Obama administration, who, to his great shame, intervened against your side, right? And in support of the fossil fuel industry, which is really outrageous.
We filed this case against the Obama administration. The fossil fuel industry petitioned the courts to intervene. They became intervener defendants. We did not originally sue them. They petitioned to be on this case because they saw that if we won, our case would impact their business and their industry, and so therefore they wanted to have a stake in the trial and hearings.
I guess what I meant to say was Obama and the fossil fuel industry were on the same side.
Yes, they are, and the administration is still on the same side. They quite literally sit at the same table together.
So is there anything different because we have a new president? Did you have to refile, or are you taking advantage of the climate march coming up to get a bigger megaphone for your already filed case?
Yes, what we're doing with this climate march and with Trump as the new administration is that we're just amplifying the necessity of this case and the urgency of this case, and we're rallying people to join our movement as kind of the last chance for climate. So we do not have to refile. All we do is we just rename the lead defendant. The lead defendant is now Trump, and all of the heads of the agencies that we filed are also, you know, those are updated to fit the new administration.
And do you have an actual date?
We do not. It's the end of this year, and you know the defendants are going to try and push that and delay further. But we are pretty adamant. You know, no, we will have our case heard by the end of this year.
But that isn't up to you, though, totally, right?
That's up to the courts, and we are confident that we will meet that target date. It's in the 9th District, so we're going to hear that case in Oregon, in Eugene.
As part of the press conference, the 14 young plaintiffs who were present read excerpts from federal Judge Ann Aiken's ruling last fall, introduced by lead plaintiff Kelsey Juliana.
We're here today to tell you what the judiciary has to say about our rights, our future, the role of federal courts, from this court on down. On November 10th of last year, Judge Ann Aiken denied the attempts of the U.S. government and the fossil fuel industry to dismiss our case. We're honored to stand here on these steps and read to you some of our favorite passages from this landmark decision. This is no ordinary lawsuit.
This lawsuit is not about proving that climate change is happening or that human activity is driving it.
This action is of a different order than the typical environmental case. It alleges the defendant's actions and inactions, whether or not they violate any specific statutory duty, have so profoundly damaged our home planet that they threaten plaintiffs' fundamental constitutional rights to life and liberty.
At its heart, this lawsuit asks this court to determine whether defendants have violated plaintiffs' constitutional rights.
The Declaration of Independence and the Constitution did not create the rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The documents are instead vehicles for protecting and promoting those already existing rights.
And the Founding Fathers were influenced by intergenerational considerations.
They believed the inalienable rights to life, liberty, and property were rooted in a philosophy of intergenerational equity.
The genius of the Constitution is that it allows future generations to protect the rights of all persons to enjoy liberty as we learn its meaning.
Plaintiffs do not seek to have this court direct any individual agency to issue or enforce any particular regulation.
Rather, they ask the court to declare the United States' current environmental policy infringes their fundamental rights and direct the agencies to implement an enforceable national plan to stabilize the climate system.
Even when a case implicates hotly contested political issues, the judiciary must not shrink from its role as a co-equal branch of government.
Federal courts retain broad authority to fashion practical remedies when confronted with complex and intractable constitutional violations.
Just as marriage is the foundation of the family, a stable climate system is quite literally the foundation of society, without which there would be neither civilization nor progress.
Exercising my reasoned judgment, I have no doubt that the right to a climate system capable of sustaining human life is fundamental to a free and ordered society.
That was Kelsey Juliana, lead plaintiff in a lawsuit to force the federal government to address climate change, followed by 14 of the 21 plaintiffs reading from Judge Ann Aiken's court decision in their favor. For more information on our Children's Trust climate change lawsuit, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WUML in Lowell, Massachusetts, WRFN in Nashville, Tennessee, WXDR in New Orleans, Louisiana, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.